I don't know what it actually do, a diffraction type device, you know, like a, I don't know, something that will like focus, create a focal point. What was really the intention of the Fresnel plate, Dick? To act like a Fresnel lens type device, over?
Okay, the people who know French pronounce it Fresnel. Although it's spelled Fresnel, they pronounce it Fresnel. And a Fresnel lens is made out of glass. It looks a little bit like a magnifying glass, but it's got a bunch of steps in the glass. That's a Fresnel lens. A Fresnel step zone plate also tries to act like a magnifying glass, but it's completely flat. Let me explain how it works. Take an ordinary magnifying glass. Take a point source like the sun, shine the sun through the magnifying glass, it creates a converging ray phenomenon. Put a piece of newspaper at the focal length in front of your magnifying glass, and all of the rays from the sun get focused to that point, you get a hot spot, and it eventually burns a hole in the newspaper. So, a properly shaped piece of glass in the form of a lens does focusing. It does beam bending. Okay? Now let's work it backwards. Where you have that hot spot on the newspaper, put a light-emitting diode there. Transmit the light-emitting diode backwards through the magnifying glass, and now you'll have a beam like a flashlight that you can change, that you can shine on the wall. So you've now made a flashlight. Okay? How come the lens will focus the energy? And without the lens, how come you don't get focusing? Okay? Without the lens, the energy coming out of the light-emitting diode goes off in all directions and never comes to a focus. Whereas all the energy that hits the magnifying glass, all of it gets bent into a particular direction and it becomes a nice collimated beam that hits the wall in front of you. Somebody came along with the idea that across the surface of what would have been the magnifying glass, portions of that wave are in phase and portions of the wave are out of phase, compared to the collimated wave you want to generate like a flashlight beam. So what they do is they generate a whole bunch of rings that are inside of each other. The rings have 50% duty factor. In other words, you alternate between transparent rings and opaque rings. By the opaque rings, you take out all of the outer phase energy by simply absorbing it, and by the transparent rings, you allow the in-phase energy to flow through. When you do that correctly, you've now created a completely flat magnifying glass that has 50% efficiency. Half of the energy absorbed, half of the energy has flowed through, but you've only allowed the energy to flow through that was in-phase to make a collimated beam. So it's an inexpensive flat lens, but because it runs inefficiency of 50% or a little bit lower, it's not an attractive approach. It's an interesting science experiment, a Fresnel step zone lens. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, so let me just understand it now. I can see, I know what, now I basically know what you're talking about, the lenses they have in the lighthouse that use for navigation. You said collimate. Okay, we collimate the RF signal during transmit, okay? What happens, what is it doing when the signal is coming the other way? If I can see a lens, you know, with a fast bulb behind it, shining out to see, and creating a, I guess, some kind of a convergence of some sort out there. But when it comes to RF, I would assume that if it collimates the RF during, say, transmit, what the heck is it doing during the receive, Dick? Oh, you have to take it away, over?
Not at all. You literally could put a magnifying glass at the right focal length and the right distance in front of your gun flexor, and it would focus energy in a particular direction. It would probably have about 15 dB of gain. Now, glass is somewhat absorptive at 10 gigs. It's not the ideal way to make a lens. You could take the right kind of foam or plastic material, shape it into a double convex lens or a plano convex lens, and literally focus the RF energy coming out of your complexer. The Militech company makes a whole lot of products that use what's called quasi-optical RF techniques, quasi-optical millimeter wave techniques. Those wavelengths coming out of the gunplexer are a lot bigger than the waves that come out of the bulb of your flashlight, but they can be focused the exact same way. So you can build a lens in front of a gunplexer, and it will work. And you can make it out of foam, you can make it out of plastic, you could make it out of glass, but you'll get a more efficient use of, let's say, Teflon, with the right shape. And now you're about to ask the question, which gives you more gain, a horn or a lens? And that's a little bit like asking, which would make a better girlfriend, a blonde or a brunette? They each have their advantages. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay. All right, I understand that. Okay, so it collimates the RF, pointed out there, and sort of, like you said, gives us maybe a little bit better signal at some distance. What happens during receipt? What is the lens doing during receipt? How does it? I can see the lens, but you know, shining, you know, with a bulb behind it, shining out. But what happens is your RF, when it has to go through the plate the other way, take over.
Okay, what it does with RF and what it does with light are almost identical. I've got a light-emitting diode at the focal length of my magnifying glass, and the light that's now focused by the magnifying glass becomes a collimated beam, like a flashlight beam. If I now fire the thing in reverse, I aim this whole thing at the sun, a planar wave coming from the sun hits the magnifying glass, gets converged, and it will now focus it down to the light-emitting diode and burn it up for you. A lens obeys, is a kind of an antenna. It's a focusing device, it's a kind of antenna, and it obeys the law of reciprocity. Whatever it does on transmit, it does the exact same thing on receive, and is desirable in both directions. If it's got 15 dB of gain on transmit, it's got 15 dB of gain on receive. You don't take it away on reception, you leave it there. If it gives you a benefit on transmission, it's going to give you the exact same benefit on reception. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, now I've got to think what you're talking about. Oh, so in other words, it's a collimate when you're putting RF through it during transmit and focusing it back in on receive. Well, in other words, you're talking like an optical type, what they used to call an optical converging lens. Is that what you're referring to, Dick? Over.
Absolutely, positively. And when you do this at millimeter wave frequencies, they call it quasi-optical millimeter wave antenna technique. And if you understand how a magnifying glass works, you'll know how to make millimeter wave antennas, and you're going to love it. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, now I can picture what this contraption is. Never saw one. I don't guess it was never a device that was sold. All right, let's see. I think we, anybody, first of all, anybody have any questions on any of this so-called stuff? I guess we most probably lost the audience by now, anyhow. All right, let me read on here. What else we got here? Down the line here. One time you demonstrated for a club a little gadget you made up. I did. What did I demonstrate? A directional coupler that you made up. What the heck did I make up? A directional coupler? Where was it? Directional coupler for testing. You tested the hand with the handy talking testing, and you said you made it used a T connect, a aluminum T, conduit T. He never did make up any schematics or publish anything on how to construct this wonderful gadget. I know a few people that have it, but they don't remember how the details of putting such a thing together. You know, this was a, I made up a directional couplet some time ago. I'll tell you what it's about, I don't know. Do you want to bother with this now?
That's a very important component in the microwave UHF world. I use directional couplers every day of my life, Mel. The average ham radio operator only has a partial understanding of them and would definitely benefit from more understanding. Not quite as much benefit as from a Smith chart lecture, but they would benefit a whole lot. The most prevalent directional coupler that every amateur radio operator has seen and touched and used is the slug on a bird wattmeter or any other kind of a standing wave ratio indicator. Every standing wave ratio indicator is a directional coupler. You can select and measure the amount of energy flowing forward on your transmission line. You can select and measure the amount of energy flowing backward on your transmission line. And those ratios, we call it forward to reverse energy ratio, we call it standing wave ratio, we call it reflection coefficient, we call it S11, we call it reflective power. Directional couplers are darn important. The average amateur barely knows the word, doesn't know the concept, doesn't know the benefit. And there's significant benefit, and I think it's worth going to, whenever you want to. Your choice, Mel.
Okay, I'll give a brief description as I remember. I have a couple of them here. Basically, what it was that a number of people had asked me, you know, to check their handy talkie out and tell me if it's still putting out the power it does, is the antenna working right, about the ducky, you know, was right. And I used to drag around the bird watt meter, and I decided that now that bouncing the thing around is not a good idea, it gets beat up and all. It's a great instrument, it's more or less an instrument. Say on my bench. So I came up with this homemade thing. I took a aluminum tee. You know, ever seen? Are you familiar with these electrical tees they use outside to screw together three pieces of aluminum pipe when they're using outside? It has a plate on it to make the connection, and then you close the plate up. Can you picture what I'm talking about, Dick? Over.
Okay. Is this a junction box? Is this a T used with conduit tubing, or is this a T used for the aluminum tubing that's used for a guardrail? Back to you, Mel.
No, this is what electrical, electrical tubing, EMT, I believe it's electromedical tubing. It's one that looks like a T, and they use it to join together, you know, screw together three pieces of conduit for, you know, electrical systems, especially where it's going to be exposed to the weather. You know, you can make a good plumbing with the threaded. You know, they got 3 half-inch threaded ports, Dick. You picture it, and a plate goes over it. They call it the pull plate. You picture one of them, over.
I can picture the T. I can see the 3 conduit tubings, EMT tubings, threaded going into it. The plate that goes over it, the pull plate. I'm having a little trouble picturing that. I might not have seen one of those.
Hey, the plate is just a long plate with a screw on each end of it. So after you make the electrical connections inside the little, you know, unit, you put this plate back onto it, Dick, over.
Okay. Would you call that a breakout box?
Oh, they're not breakout boxes because they're not round. They're actually in the shape of a T. And they have, like I say, the open port. If you want to close the open port, any one of the open ports, you get one of these screw-in blank plugs, over.
Okay, I think I can picture that. But it's got a plus plate over the top that gets screwed down, so that after you've done your twist tying of the wires on the inside, you put the plate over it in order to protect it.
Actually, the plate is on the side. You know, or if you looked at it, it looks like it's either a port up on top and a port on either side. And the plate, this aluminum plate, goes over it with a gasket if it's outside. I don't know what the heck, maybe Paul, I think he's an electrician. What is the correct electrical name for such a device, Paul, if you're still on frequency, over?
No, I'm not an electrician, Mel, so I can't help you. Well, I know it's the 1900 boxes and the outdoor boxes, of course, but now... trying to picture what you're talking about, but I'm not getting it either. Back him up.
It's called a T-Condolette, KC2FDT.
A T-Condolette. How could you spell that one?
Oh, you're asking for a lot now, Dick. My spelling isn't very good. Condolette, C-O-N-G-U-L-E-T-T-E. You're asking for a good one, Mel. That's why I became an electrician rather than a bookmark guy.
You got it, Mel.
Okay, that's the name, Condolette. Okay, you can buy it any electrical supply, Home Depot or whoever. It's made out of aluminum, like I say. It's got that plate. You see them around times on the side of buildings where they've added, like, air conditioners to, you know, the old houses, the rooms, so they come up on the outside of buildings. And they'll put these different right, they got them in right angles, they got them in T's and all. So I took one of these. I happened to see it in electrical supply, so I took one of them. And what I did is, on each blank plug, just like if they screw on each side, I drilled the center of the blank plug on each side, and I put a piece of copper tubing from end to end, BNC, put a BNC connector on either end, after I drilled out the blank plug, screwed it back in, put the BNC connector in, and in between it, I put this, what, 5/16 copper tubing, take a length of it to go from, in other words, right across it, and leave the top port, that's where the probe comes in. Can you picture this so far, over?
Yes, I think I can. And I'm also looking up T-Condolette right now.
Okay, now, in the top port, I made up this little device that fits into the top port, and basically had a feed-through, a resistor, a diode, and another terminating resistor. And that extended down into the chamber, you want to call it. And on the bottom of the chamber was a copper plate bent in the shape of like a crushed down U, I guess that's the way you can call it. It was about 3/4 inch flat, and it came up about 1/8 inch, and it curled back over went to the terminal side. Two standoff terminals inside that I made. I actually turned a piece of printed circuit board and put a couple of feed throughs as mounting and put the little diode and pickup assembly right there. And it extended straight up through the blank plug. I drilled a hole through a feed through. And what you would do once the thing is all adjusted up, you could use it in one direction. You put it on there with, and you could stick your little, your handheld on there and read the forward power, and if you want to then, you know, with a dummy load, and if you wanted to check the radio, the antenna, say, for FWR, you turn the directional coupler around, and where the antenna is now, you put the little rig, or the little handheld, and you put the antenna on the other side, so now it becomes an FWR bridge. Can you picture this contraption, over?
Yes, I do. And, Doug DeMore, is that the right kind? Yeah, Doug DeMore built a somewhat similar thing out of copper tubing and top copper tubing T connectors, and had an article in QST magazine on this, 25 years ago. Back to you.
I guess so. I most likely saw that, but I made a simple device because, you know, I made it up so that you don't have to have a torch or anything. All you need is an electric drill to make this thing a file. A little, you know, just a little handwork, actually. So everything was more or less, very simple with the twerk. I think if I remember, that was the complaint, that the one that Doug made up. But once it's assembled, you couldn't adjust it. This thing, the cover, side cover, is off, so you see everything, you know, how the everything is mounted. You can then take a little stick, like a little piece of dowel, and you can bend and everything and adjust it to, you know, the correct settings for forward and reverse with a dummy load, and, you know, and then close it up, Dick, over.
And when you do those adjustments, you're adjusting the directivity When it's in the forward mode, you want to measure forward power and not see any of the reverse power, and vice versa. But by setting this thing up in the forward mode and the reverse mode into a known good dummy load and doing those adjustments, you're adjusting the directivity, and that tells you the purity of its directional coupler characteristic. Back to you, Mel.
Basically, that's what's it. I don't know, somewhere around, I have the diagram of the dimensions of all the little things inside it, of the rod, the copper pipe, and the making up of that pickup. And that was the part, really, that made it simple, because you have the side plate off, and you can do all the twerking of it, and, you know, and then when it corrects everything, you just close it up, and it's a rugged little device because, you know, that high school aluminum casing. And as I said, you didn't need any fancy type of tools to make this thing up because most of it is constructed already. You buy and you complete the casing. You're just going to drill some holes in the plug and add in the few devices there. So I think that's basically what I showed that time to the club. And they made up a number of them, a number of guys using them. And then, in fact, I even suggested you make up two of them exactly, put one way, one the other, and simultaneously read both forward and reverse stick over.
Yeah, and there's a version of that as a commercial product, which is the dual needle Vizwar meter. It measures forward power and reverse power, and where the two needles cross, you look at the scale, and it tells you what the standing wave ratio is. It gives you three pieces of information in one view of the metering system. Also, when you go to the appropriate chapter of the ARRL antenna book, they have a number of standing wave ratio meter designs and directional coupler designs. One of the very early ones, I don't know if it's still in the book, is where you would take a piece of RG8U cable and literally snake a piece of enameled wire under the braid for a few inches along the cable, and where the enamel wire comes out on the two places through the braid without making contact with the braid, you then hook up some external resistors and capacitors and switches, and that becomes a directional coupler once it's properly mounted in the right kind of a holding fixture. So it's amazing how easy a directional coupler is to make. The tuning process for it, to the average person, is a little bit spooky, although if you follow a good article which tells you you do this step and you do that step and you vary this resistor until you get that response, and all of a sudden you are setting the directivity. So directional couplers are very easy to build in many cases, not so easy to understand where the magic comes from. It appears to be a violation of reciprocity. How can the thing respond to a signal that flows to the right without responding to a signal that flows to the left on the exact same transmission line? That's kind of a little bit of magic there. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, I guess when I showed it, they thought what kind of magic contraption I got here, but all they needed was their digital voltmeter, their handheld digital voltmeter, and when I demonstrated, they all marveled at this thing, and I make such a thing, and I showed them basically how easy it is to make such a thing. And it was duplicated many times. I guess the nice part of it was that all you had to do was go into any electrical supply place for like $1.50. You had the whole casing and everything, and the plugs that screw in the side. Everything screws together, basically. You just solder it all, you know, once it's in place, just solder everything up. And that's it. And the only extra components you had there, really, was two resistors and a diode. That was the whole deal thing. So this is what I'm referring to. I don't know. I have all the figures, how, you know, what the length of each little piece of the pipe, how much it cut, and how I put together the probe and everything. But I have to find this for this gentleman, and I could always either fax it or whatever, or send him in the mail how this is. But this was basically that's what it is, a directional coupler, as Dick just mentioned. Go ahead, Dick.
Sounds like a fun lecture. How long ago did you give that lecture? And was it before the Kings County Radio Club?
many years. What happened was, my friend in Pennsylvania, my friend George, a very good friend of mine, D3FRY, when repeaters first came into, you know, use, we were using, if you remember, a TR-22. Heck, that was my first, if you want to call it a handheld or portable or whatever, FF2-meter rig. That was it. In fact, I ran a marathon with it, believe it or not, once. Unbelievable when I did that craziness many years ago. And he wanted to put a repeater together in PA. And we took a TR-22, we separated it off the receiver up close, you know, and you take that TR-22 apart, you know, and you got a receiver board, you got a transmitter board, also with the crystals on each. And we separated the two. I made up a cavity out of copper pipe, out of drain pipe of all things. That's what I made the cavity out of, drain pipe, 4-inch drain pipe, round copper drain pipe. I made up a cavity. And we put up the thing we made. It was a 1-watt repeater, Dick, over.
There are people who have made a repeater out of a pair of IC-2AT handy talkies. So, this repeater, you located it where, and what kind of range were you getting out of it?
Basically, we put it there in Pennsylvania, where he had a big woodland behind him. He was there in western Pennsylvania, where he moved to another location now, but still western Pennsylvania, just went up higher. But in the back of that, there's this woodland that stretched forever. And his kids, boys, like to hunt and fish and all that kind of stuff. They've got their ham license. And this way, he figured to keep in touch. So what they did, we put this thing up there. And it worked terrific. It would cover a good number of miles into the woodlands. And that was at the beginning, until everybody then started to get attracted to it. They all started buying TR-22s and all, whatever. Was around, wasn't much of a selection those days because of portable two-meter radios, of FM radios. And that was the beginning of it. It was just a wonderful working 1-watt repeater. And the ID in the repeater was a continuous tape. We had a little tape recorder that would had a timer on it, and every 10 minutes it would just switch on and say, WB3FRY repeater. And it would keep this little relay on and just broadcast that out with a continuous loop tape ticked over.
Yeah, WB3FRY, George F. Chiripka, Jr., now lives in North Versailles, Pennsylvania. Very far western Pennsylvania, I can tell. He's in grid Fox November 00. So I think he's out there in the Pittsburgh area. Is that the, approximately right? Is that the way you pronounce his last name? Chiripka?
Chiripka. It's North Versailles. Yeah, it's not the French pronunciation. Like we say, Houston Street here in Texas, they say Houston. It's North Versailles, PA. Yeah, we were out there and moved to a nice high location there. He used to be over in a place called Wilmerding. Oh, God, that's where Westinghouse had the plan to build the air brake called Wilmerding, PA. And Westinghouse's wife was named Wilmerding. So she was always ashamed of a name, so they built the, when he built the town, well, Westinghouse, he named it Wilmerding. From there to North Versailles, PA, that's western Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh, Dick, over.
Now, this is a much younger fellow than you, Mel. He was born in 1944. He's in Allegheny County.
He's 4 years younger than us. So, approximately 4 years younger than us. And, he's quite a columns collector. He's got about 50 columns written and towers, with you name it. Really into ham radio, and that was the beginning. So that's how we came up with one of the first repeaters. You talk about, you know, really just the bare essentials of putting a repeater together, a converted handy little TR-22, and homemade cavities and everything. And it worked, ran it for years. Believe it or not, it ran for literally years, Dick. Never gave a problem, over.
Now run that play again. did you tell me that your buddy George, 5050 Collins Riggs? Wow. That is a collector. That is an enthusiast. That's a passion. That's almost an obsession. Where in the world does he contain 50 Collins Riggs? He must have something as big as a three-car garage as a museum just to house all these things. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, Dick, WX2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
You should see the pictures of his train layout. This guy must be a big-time collector. Lionel train? It looks like the real thing.
Oh, you went to his website from QRZ.com? Is that what you did, Paul?
No, I got on because Mel introduced him to me on the air, and this guy sent pictures of his train layout because he knew I was interested in the Lionel train. I'm telling you, this thing looks real. I mean, his close-up view, the background, he can run 16 trains at one time, so I guess it's... You're a collector and everything. Now, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. Mr. George is really into stuff. He should be his gun collection. That's another thing. Oh, God. Got enough there to supply a small army. All kinds of guns, rifles, things. I don't know what half of that stuff I need to look at. The trains are magnificent. Oh, what a collection of trains. It is a phenomenal amount of track. Little things that light up and buzz, bridges, and you name it. And he's passionate about that also. Yeah, Paul got on a couple times with us on 75 meetings. George, I should say he's an expert on trains, on model trains. And Collins Riggs take over.
Wow. Where does he contain those 50 Collins Riggs? Are they in some kind of a great big showroom, Mel?
I gotta tell you the history thing. George has had six kids, and so he had a very big house with a lot of bedrooms. They all have moved out except for one. So he had a lot of extra room. And a big, big basement. I mean a huge basement. And so the trains were down the basement, all set up. You never see a setup like that. They went like through tunnels that looked like they were dug out in the wall or something. And upstairs, he built a radio room. The room must have been 12 by 14 feet, and they had shelves, you know, stacks of shelves and everything, and desks that went all the way around the room and. You have no idea. It just was, you stood there and you just had to stand for 5 minutes just turning your head back and forth to get the panoramic view of this thing take over.
Now, according to Paul, he's using Lionel trains, which are, I think, called 027 gauge or something like that, really big. Whereas if he was using HO or N gauge, you could make an elaborate setup without filling up an acre. Are these really Lionel three-track type large trains that he's got this great big setup on? That's question number one. And question number two, what is or was George's occupation? How did he finance all of this? Go ahead.
As far as the trains go, I don't know. I'm not an expert on that. That's Paul, tell him what kind of trains they are, over.
Yeah, the 027 is a standard three-track setup. And it was interesting. Mel says, "Yeah, get on. You know, this guy's on 80 meters. So I want to try out 80. What I wanted to do is I wanted to hear Mel's antenna, you know, the loop. But this guy was on, and Mel says, you know, this guy's George FRY. I happened to mention about the trains. I was trying to bring back the life." Trains that I've had for 50 years, and this guy, you know, said, oh, I know, and one thing led to another. He sent pictures, and I heard descriptions, and yeah, that's what he's got. He, you know, I was talking about this one transformer. By the way, Mel, I did get a hold of this, my transformer, my old transformer with the four controls to do four at one time.
And he told me, no, I have four. I said he meant four trains. He's got four transformers to run 16 trains at one time. You know, these things are big. You know, well, you remember. And I don't know how much room it takes up, but in fact, you do.
Oh, wow. That is an enthusiast. Back to you, Mel.
I don't want to tell you about my friend Woody, because you'll fall off the chair. What he just did this past summer, that's a whole other story itself. But well, anyhow, we put together the repeater, and if you really can't imagine what was going on there with all this stuff. Unbelievable. I mean, so did his house, and he had an organ. Oh, that's a whole other story. He had this pipe organ. Dick, it was a monster. It was a monster. I don't know how he got it into the house. It was unbelievable. I mean, I just was just completely flabbergasted at what was going on there. What George's, he was an insurance rep there in that area. He represented Prudential. Prudential had an insurance office, Dick, over.
Nice occupation. And obviously he's done well. Oh, amazing. So, your other friend, I think you said his name is Fred. Give me a couple of words. What did he do this unusual this summer?
Okay, Woody. He bought a piece of property in New Hampshire. And quite a piece of property on an 800-foot mountain. And he just had put up, he had a design system designed by M2. And they installed a 187-foot tower, rotating tower. And on top of it, he was on with it Friday night. He put on top of the tower a three-element 80-meter beam. The whole tower is full of beams. If you ever want to go look at his website, you'll see another contraption, another guy that possessed to some extent. I won't tell you about the ham equipment he bought, because that's a whole other story. You could put a down payment on another house. But that tower he put up, and they're all, I guess maybe next summer they take a trip to take a look at this thing. But if you really want to take a peek at it, just WW1WW, Dick, over.
Is it a double W before the one and a double W after the one? Whiskey, whiskey, one, whiskey, whiskey, is that his call letters?
My check.
Wow. Okay, 187-foot tower with a three-element 80-meter rotating Yagi on it. That's almost like that guy in Japan with the five element on a 180-foot long boom on top of an apartment building, about a six-story apartment building. Wow. Okay. That's enough that'll allow me to find him, and I'm going to look at that later on. Back to you, Mel. Maybe you ought to go back to the mailbag. He's a mind blower. Are all hams as crazy as this, Mel?
I just... You see how... So I say to myself, you tell me, wow, that guy Collins Rigg, or whatever. I'm a beginner, Dick. We're just amateurs. These guys are at it. Oh, the things that... You want to listen to some of these guys on 75 meters, this is absolutely nothing considering what they've got, that antenna range. You take a look. You want to look at another one? K3LR. Take a look at his setup. I tell you, you go to his location, and you see his Radio Shack, this building that he put together with eight stations in this building. Eight stations, all with kilowatts. And then look at the towers out there. Oh, my God, there's a range of towers. I don't know. There must be half a dozen towers out there, every one of them 100-plus feet tall. It's mind-boggling, Dick, over.
Mel, these guys need a hobby. There's a pun there somewhere. Wow.
They say, we're just beginning, Dick. These guys really know what to do. And this is all on 75 meters, and you meet some really unusual stations. All right, let's go on with a little time. Oh, a little time. Yeah, very little time left. Let me see if I can take something here that we have. Looking down here, most of these are going to be somewhat involved. Here's one. Let's see. Maybe you can do a tutelage on DB. I think I did that one. But please keep this simple. I'm new to ham radio, but I'm not a youngster. And when you start with all that math, please leave out that miserable L word that I keep reading when I read about DB. Maybe you can give a simple explanation. You know, I've been through this with the kids and all, you know, with high school kids and a couple of times on lectures and all, how to explain DB without getting into that miserable L word. So I guess we'd have to leave that for next week because that's a bit involved, Dick, over.
Maybe we can give a quick thumbnail sketch. It all came about because the human seeing system, the human hearing system, work in a blank way, that L word, I'll say it once, logarithmic manner. Another way of wording it is a geometric manner. In other words, in order for a big jump in sound level to take place, the sound has to go 10 times louder. And if you want to make another big jump in sound level, it's got to go 10 times louder again, a total of 100 times louder. The human hearing and the human eye sensitivity works like that. There's a bunch of reasons why Mother Nature designs it that way. It's in order to give the system enough dynamic range. That really means enough ability to listen to a very weak signal and enough ability to listen to a very strong signal and get both of them in a very linear manner. So, common sense would lead you to believe if I've got a certain amount of sound and I want it to sound twice as loud to my hearing system, you would double the amount of sound level. It doesn't work that way. You have to multiply by 10 for a certain amount of significant increase where the person says, yeah, that got louder. You have to go up roughly 10 to 1. The mathematics to how to do that is what decibels are trying to duplicate. And so you can either learn the math or you can memorize it. When I've got two transmitters and one has a single watt, the other one has 10 watts, the 10 watt transmitter is 10 decibels louder than the 1 watt transmitter. If I compare the 10 watt transmitter to a 100 watt transmitter, 10 decibels again. And here's the hard part. When you go from 1 watt to 10 watts, that's a 10 dB increase. 10 watts to 100 watts, that's a 10 dB increase. Therefore, you would say when you go from 1 watt to 100 watts, it's 10 and 10, or a 20 decibel increase. The answer is yes. Decibels do work that way. They work by multiplication. If I go from 1 watt to 1,000 watts, that's a 30 decibel increase. So you could say the number of zeros after the 1 equals the number of 10 times in decibels. When I go from 1 to 10, I've added 1 zero. When I go from 100, I've added 2 zeros. When I go from 1 to 1,000, I've added 3 zeros. Add 1 zero, 10 dB. Add
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Add 2 zeros, it's 20 dB. Add 3 zeros, 30 dB. So, people have memorized what happens when you move in tens and convert it into dBs. They've memorized that. And it's a similar thing when you change by 2 to 1 in power. It's a 3 dB increase, a 4 to 1 in power increase, and a 6 dB increase. That's about as much memorization as people go through. 2 to 1, 3 dB, 4 to 1, 6 dB, 10 to 1, 10 dB. And then you can start putting them together in combination. 1 watt to 10 watts, 10 dB increase. 1 watt to 100 watts, 20 dB increase. 100 watts to 200 watts is a 3 dB increase. Therefore, if I jump from 1 to 200, it is 20 plus 3 or 23 dB. Of course, it sounds crazy. You have to write these down as sort of a memorization chart. It will make a little bit more sense. the mathematics behind it all is called logarithm. And unfortunately, in high school, a lot of people were given an extremely poor introduction to logarithms, and therefore it became something they hated. There are very few schools that have a very good math teacher. Therefore, there are very few students that get a good introduction to mathematics. Therefore, they end up hating the subject. All the females in my house are math hostile. They've all had really bad high school math teachers. In most cases, the high school math teacher was a biology teacher, and the principal said, "You're going to teach math this semester." To which he said, "Oh, hell, I don't want to do that, but all right, I want to stay occupied. I want to stay employed." And you stand in front of that teacher, and you can learn to hate that subject also. K2KUI, K2RIW.
I just got a nod here. Alona says to me, she says, the only thing she took out of high school math was how to balance the checkbook. She says the rest of it was nonsense. And that's it. You hit it on the butt, on the, right on the nail on the head, Dick. The teaching of math. I had to sing with the kids here, and I said, what? My God, is going through their heads and trying to explain how to do this and the math, how they put it together as a concoction. And I would sit with them and explain it and everything, and come up and show them how to do it, and they say, oh, that's what it's all about. Yeah. Went back to school, and one of the teachers said, well, saw how my daughter derived on the answer and all, and she says, where did you get this from and everything? She says, well, my dad showed me how to do it. Well, it's not right. No, she says, don't you dare say that. My dad knows. He's an engineer. He knows math. So that started a whole controversy. I went up to the school and climbed up to a whole other deal. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll say a few words about CD. We'll start at the beginning. We'll continue next week. In fact, so I'll give you a little bit of the background of how it came about, first of all. Right, in the beginning, when Alexander Graham Bell was awarded the patent for the telephone system, right away they started realizing certain factors that they never counted on, because when they started running wire, things started to happen. So what they did to begin with, the first experiment that they did was with wire. They took wire a mile long. That was their so-called standard. Their first standard was a length of wire a mile long, and they had to decide basically what kind of wire to use. And through experiments, they found that number 19 copper wire was ideal for their situation for going a mile. They also had to determine what frequency response of the system makes for intelligibility. And they found that between 300 cycles per second to 3,000 cycles per second. So what they did, because of their math, they decided to use 1,000 cycles per second. So this was their standard, called their TU, the Terminal Unit Standard. 1 mile of wire, number 19, 300 to 3,000 cycles, but used 1,000 cycles as the standard. 1,000 cycles, 1 mile, number 19, copper wire. That became their terminal unit. And, of course, now comes the situation. Well, you start running wires and things like that, and your signal starts to drop off, so we start thinking about transformers and capacitors and all these goodies. And now the debate is, you put this on the line, improving. How much does it improve? Well, they had people sitting there and testing the system and saying, well, it sounds this better, this sounds that. Well, they needed a measurement to find out how much gain the system has. Let me let it drop for a second. Okay? So what they did, they finally tuned and pruned this sounding unit, this thousand cycle sounding unit that they used. Actually, was some kind of a contraption they made up with a tuning fork. And they found that the human hearing can only discern at least a 20% change in the level before it can recognize a difference. It had to be at least 20% according to the test they made. So what they did is finally they found that if they could increase, kept increasing until they went 10 times the original sound going into the transmitter, the mic you talked into on the telephone those days, they call it the transmitter, and the thing you put by ear was called the receiver, and they found they went 10 times that. They called that in honor of the owner of the company, Mr. Bell. They called that One Bell. Does that sound right to you, Dick Overton?
It sure does. The basic unit is a bell. But a bell is a very big unit. It's a 10-to-1 ratio in power. So someone decided, hey, let's make a little bit finer units, one-tenth as big, and they called them a decibel. You could have also created a millibel and a microbel, but we haven't used those units. I have. And a kilobel. Look out for a kilobel. That's deafening, but bell is the basic unit, and the little subunit that we use most often is decibel. You've got it, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, so now they got this bell, like this big set. Going to go from bell one to bell another bell, you know, that was the ear splitting. So they decide they got to chop it up. They got to have something, you know, more increments to work with. So what a guy got, and he says, well, he says a human hearing hears 20% discerned over the line. That means if 80% of the signal goes through, aha, that sounds like, you know, a system that is working quite well. However, he says, you know, there goes the mathematician, a little twerking of this 80%. Why don't we make it 79.436? No, 79.4326, or better known as 79.4%. And they said, well, what the heck is the practicality of that? Very well, very simple. If you take 79.4%, and a qubit. In other words, multiply 79.4 by itself 3 times, you come out with 50%. Aha! 50%. 50% means 50% more power 3 times. Hey, we'll call that 3 dB. How about that, Dick?
Yeah, 1 decibel is 0.794328, so on. Each of our calculators will give that to us very nicely. But yes, mathematically it works out nice. Teaching somebody that math, depending on their background, can be a bit difficult. We've got about 3 minutes left, so we got to start signing off now. Go ahead.
Okay, so keep that in mind. That then we'll go on from there, and I'll show you how easy it is, how they went ahead, how you can break it up and understand. So now, hey, 3 dB, 50%, hey, 50% of the power and everything. This became convenient ways of working. And I'll show you how now you can add them up and subtract them. And without the L word, understand how dB really work. We'll go from here on. I'll make a mark on my notes here. I've done this so many times, you know, verbatim, you know, how I thought it. And everybody usually at the end says, now I understand. I just say, all because of the way they teach logarithm was, I think, one of the most misunderstood, misused, non-used thing that was so straightforward that, you know, you show people a logarithmic table, Dick, you may as well, be Greek to them, over.
Yep, and it's not that bad. It's just that they've all had a lousy introduction to it. This country would be a lot better off if people had a little bit less hostility to math and a little bit less hostility to science. And in both cases, many of the schools are giving them a poor introduction. And because the teacher is not interested in that subject, he tries to convince the student not to be interested in that subject, either subliminally or directly. And that's sad. Because an awful lot of our progress is coming from those two areas. Math is nice when it comes to adding up the groceries in the supermarket or balancing your checkbook. There's quite a bit more math you could be using. Maybe calculating the miles per gallon of your car and what happens when you inflate the tires properly and so on. Math is a tool. You can't hate the tool. Oxygen is a element. You can't hate the element. We like oxygen. With the right attitude, you could like math. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1166. You wasted the last 3.8 hours of your life listening to these two guys. It's your choice if you want to do it again next week. Looks like decibels and Smith charts will be discussed among any other subject. And 80% of the time, the subjects we discuss are the ones you bring to the table. The ones that you're interested in. What's on your mind now? And it's nothing, Mel and I don't think there's anything called a dumb question. A so-called dumb question means you'd really like a little more information. You're not quite sure how to word it. That's how the beginning process of any question begins. 73, you all be kind to each other. And on the assumption our help holds up, Mel and I'll be back next week. K2KEY, go right ahead.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is K2KEY. Shall continue with the DBs, and I'll go into it, and I'll show you applications. You'll say, oh, boy, well, am I going to use this from here on. Got some real great applications. And, that was bad. Very, very badly taught. Right. We'll talk to everybody and tell everybody the story again next week. Thank you all for joining us. And as Dick said, I can answer anything within reason. I can't give you... No, I will not quote stocks or any of that kind of stuff. Give you look at technical companies and what their product is. Forget it. I'm not in that business. Keep it to amateur radio or general things like this. And morning glasses. Try to discuss it. 73 is all. Have a great week.